C1A, number 11B.
And so she goes on and comes to life as truth and says, yes. She begins with the Christian martyr and says, yes, everyone has to go and drink that cup thoroughly. Comes to the point that trials encountered by prophets, disciples, and apostles of whom the world was not worthy. See, the world is not worthy of it. It's so ridiculous with ourselves, anyway with me. I'm so ridiculous sometimes, I know it. And then I struggle, and then if I get my peace, I always get over it, and I feel always 10 times happier afterwards. But the funny thing about the human mind, it draws all its worthiness from God, and then it is that we try to be found worthy by the world. It's so hideous. But that's how the human mind is made up, and how mortal mind tries to trick us. But it's just good to have sometimes a good look at it and face it to see how truth says, well, truth is always that which says, yeah, yeah, nay, nay. Which says, yeah, yeah, I find my worthiness with God. All what my life must be found worthy is that God finds it worthy. And it's the nay, nay which says, and I don't care tuppence what the world found, if the world finds it worthy or not. I don't want to find worthiness from God, from the world. And that's our trial. But she says, every pioneer of truth has to go through that and has to eat the whole bread, and not only the bit, a little bit. It says, error repeats itself. All we have to go through. See, it says, just because Jesus has gone through the way and because he has shown the way, that doesn't relieve us from going the way too. And so we can't say those things which Jesus has worked out, those trials which he has worked out, we don't have to work out anymore. Theology says that. Theology says Jesus has worked out through trials all those things. And so we are the happy inheritors of it, you see. Science comes and says no. Those things which Jesus had to work out, we have to work out too. The history repeats itself. We just cannot go into heaven with any single error in us. And so every pioneer of truth must be found worthy for that. And then she comes to the last, to life as love, where she shows that really we have to find the climax. Perhaps I just read one of the paragraphs. There is too much animal courage in society and not sufficient moral courage. That's typically atonement and Eucharist. You have to have courage. In prayer, she never used the word courage. You don't have to have courage in prayer. Prayer, you are still with you and you are quite alone with you and so on. But when it comes to atonement and Eucharist, you have to show your worthiness in opposition to opponents. To temptation, you have to have courage. Big leaders in religion have always been brave people, always been brave people, always courageous people. Only whole men and women can be religious leaders. They need courage. Christians must take up arms against error, and now you get the tone of love, you see. Must take up arms against error at home and abroad. Must be universal. The belief, you see, the belief in persecution must be overcome in a universal way. They must grapple with sin in themselves and in others. It must be universal. And continue this warfare, see, it's a continuation of this warfare, until they have finished their course, get the tone of love, of fulfillment. If they keep the faith, they will have the crown of rejoicing. Can you hear how she always comes at, when you're at home, you look up how the tone of love always gives that wonderful sense. You take part in God, you have the crown of rejoicing, you finish your course with joy, always is that. It's always showing, atonement is that powerful life, which says, lay down the false sense of life, and if you do, I lead you from the cross to the crown with joy. Then the bitterness is over, then the joy sets in. Christian experience teaches faith in the right and disbelief in the wrong. It bids us work more earnestly in times of persecution because then our labor is more needed. Grace is the reward of self-sacrifice, so we may never receive it in this world. Grace is the reward of self-sacrifice. You see, she says, First, she says it must be a universal warfare. We must overcome it in us and in others, at home and abroad. It must be overcome as a claim as such, and not as a personal claim. Persecution and all that misrepresentation must be seen as a claim as such. And then she says, greatest of reward for self-sacrifice. If we really can lay down that claim of a material life, the claim of material life, be it that we like to have a material life, that we want to improve a material life, the claim that the material life can be misrepresented, not valued, not accepted, not be valued, and so on, that it gives us pain and burden and so on, if we can sacrifice that sense of life, if we really can sacrifice that we ever had anything to do with another sense of life but the divine sense of life, if we can sacrifice that, great is the reward, because then nothing can touch us anymore. It's a greatness that comes out in this subject of life. I just feel we would gain so much. Perhaps you will have time at home when you go over this zone of life. Take your own life. Go and exemplify it in your own life. Perhaps first quietly in your own way of thinking this thing out straightly and finding the comforter for one's own life. Because I think practically every one of us has that burden of life carrying around with himself or herself. That burden of life which believes in life which is not God. In any sort of life which is not God. In a sort of life which says that life has come from my father, my mother. Of a sort of life which even may say that has been influenced by my grandfather, my grandmother, and my granduncle, and so on. With that sense of life which has nothing to do with God, which has a belief that that life has been formed or stamped, that it has given its outline at the act of creating, that it has been formed and molded that life in the period of prenatal existence, that that life is that life which has been molded and fashioned at the birth, that that life has been molded and fashioned and has had advantages and disadvantages through education, through surroundings, through schoolings, which has a burden of life because one had some rows and some struggles and some discourse with this and that person. Which it's a life which seems to be so burdened because one just can't forget how somebody has been nasty to us and has stood in our way and has taken away our chances and our opportunities and has been our competitor and that and that. Where we just have that sense of life that our life has been disrupted or disgusted or that it is not worthwhile and that it is little and that it is small. All that is just that one big lie of life which has nothing to do with atonement and Eucharist. If we could take that whole gamut of that lie of life and put it right away, right out of the way and say, well, what has that to do with life? What has that to do with the real life? Life is God. All right, then life is mine. Was as eternal as life. I have never been created in any human way, no in material way, only in the way of the divine mind. That's my creator. That's my beginning. That's where I draw my life from. That life is spirit. That life was never touched by the world sense of life. Has never been created into matter, born in matter, lived in matter, can never die in matter, can never be exalted out of matter. That life is always spiritual, has been spiritual, stays spiritual, is spiritual, remains spiritual, will always be spiritual. And therefore that life is of the nature of soul. Because it is spiritual, I can understand it. That life identifies itself always spiritually, and I can understand it. I can feel it and touch it spiritually. And that's what makes my life record. That's what I understand about life. That's my only life record I have. There is no other life record about me than what I understand spiritually about life. That's the only record I have. And that's a fine record. That's a satisfying record. And if I take that sense as my principle, then I can't help that life inspires me always more and more and pushes me on and on and on. opens up new vistas, new ways, new possibilities, new outlooks, new purposes, new motives. It's new and new every day. That's life. And that life is life, reflects life, comes to life as life. That life doesn't even try, doesn't even want, doesn't even look for a support from the human sense of life. It's exalted above that human sense of life. It's free and exalted about it and stands grand and sublime about it. It's that life which will stand forever. Whereas all the other talk and gossip about somebody's life just can't stand forever. It's just little flickers that pass out. But that which stands, which is eternal, which speaks for ourselves, is that life which is God's life. That stands. And so we come to life of truth and we see, oh yes, the more I demonstrate that in my life, the more I overcome every trial, the more I do that, the more sublime that is. The more my manhood comes out, the more I'm conscious of my manhood, and therefore, as love, the more universal is my manhood. The more I overcome it in myself and in others, the more I am a crown and a joy for the whole world. The more my life is a universal blessing. Great is the reward of self-sacrifice. That whole self-sacrifice has nothing to do with a mortal sense or an ethical sense of self-sacrifice. It's sacrificing a false sense of the divine life. If I can sacrifice that, then I am exalted. Then I can't drink any more the cup of tea. It's not possible. Then the reward is that I find man. And that's the sixth subject which we'll take next time. Then I find man. For the first time in the textbook, she speaks about man as the idea. First time the term idea comes in. That man is the idea of God. Then I come to real manhood. You see the beauty of this order. Shows I can't come to the sixth subject, to the birth of real manhood as the idea of God. For I have not been willing to drink the cup and lay down a material sense of manhood, material sense of atonement, material sense of life. If I have laid down that, then there is nothing more that can stand between God and man. Then man springs into life. That's what the sixth subject then will tell us. So you see how these subjects just go in one into the other. How they melt in one into the other. Well, try to get that rhythm. Try to get that rhythm more, more, more. Because it is us. We don't study some wonderful religious or theological doctrine. If we study these tones, what we study or what we consider and what we culture is man. Man. And that's what we would like to find. Because if we find man as idea of God, well, that's what is the most beautiful thing. So I think I stop here, in spite that there are a few minutes left, because I think we have done pretty well. Well, here we stop.